on the subject of stress. We call it putting stress to rest. In the first week, we tore into the subject under the title of what? Me Worry? And then last week, we talked about A for anxiety, and I happened to push the button of a lot of type A personalities who are a part of this congregation. Now this week, what I would like to talk to you about is the subject of how to be nice in the vice. I think it was Edith Bunker who said so inimitably, well, Archie, he just can't worry without getting upset. And that's your problem as well. You have yet to learn how to worry without getting upset. So when the pressures come your way, whether they be external or internal, you find yourself in such turmoil that even your temperament is affected. And then your temperament affects other people in that home. I'm not saying that it's all in the family, but there is no doubt that if Dad wakes up really grumpy in the morning, he can affect the atmosphere of that entire family just like that. Last week, I ended on 4 questions. I ask you to ask yourself these questions this week. Are you living or are you simply preparing to live? Do you know that God truly does care about what's going on in your life? The third question was, do you know the difference between the permanent and the perishable? And the fourth question was, what are you choosing off of the menu of life? When life is served up to you, what do you choose off of that menu? And what I wanted to leave you with last week is that truly, to a great extent, it lies in your court as to how you're going to negotiate stress, how you're going to handle it. Are you going to handle it constructively, or are you going to handle it destructively? It's your choice. And when you make that choice, it may be that it will involve sacrifice. See, choices often involve letting go of some things and taking hold of other things. Much like the dilemma that one little boy found himself in, you see, he had his fist wedged in his mother's valuable antique flower vase. And he screamed for help and he said, Mom, I can't get my hand out. Well, the mother's anxiety matched her son's as she came and did all she could to get his fist out of the vase. I mean, she soaked it in warm water. She swabbed that hand with some petroleum jelly, but it still wouldn't come out. And her nervousness increased as she realized the inevitable. She was going to have to break her valuable treasure. She had no other option. Even her voice got to a shrill as she said, Why did you stick your hand in the vase in the first place? I'm going to have to break my beautiful treasure at this point. And just as she was about to break it, the little boy looked up innocently and said, Mom, do you think it would help if I let go of the penny? Well, I want to tell you, that's some of your dilemmas right here. To let go of some of your worries is going to be one of the most difficult things that you will ever do. As I told you last week, you want to hang on to them. I'm not sure you're aware of it or not, but I probably ought to inform you that's exactly how they catch monkeys. True. What they will do is tie a gourd around a palm tree, and they'll fill that gourd with rice. And that monkey will go up to the gourd and stick his hand inside of it and get a handful of rice. And as long as he is clenched to the rice, his fist won't allow him to come out of the gourd. And so they'll simply walk up, take hold of the monkey, and capture him. Now some of you need to let go of the rice. You need to let go of those worries in such a way that you can go on with your life without all of this stress. You're so uptight. Remember the definition? Uptight, narrow, stringent, strict. My mother used to say, loosen up, you're tighter than Dick's hat band. I never knew what she meant by that, but I would get nervous about little things. She said, loosen up, now I've loosened up. Who gives a rip? Go through life, enjoy it. Now, some of you are not doing that. You have some choices. In fact, Walt Byrd in his book, When the Road Gets Tough, says there are 4 or 5 things you can do. You can curse your anxiety. Or you can nurse your anxiety. Some of you nurse it, don't you? You like hanging on to it. Or you can rehearse it. You can go over it again and again, and you can get real good at it. Some of you are good professional worriers. You just hang on to it and keep rehearsing it. Or you can disperse it. I don't mean divert it. I mean disperse it. In other words, you are not satisfied just to hang on to it yourself. You got to spread it to everybody else around you as well. Now, some of you, I understand, are good at that. The last thing he says you can do is this. You can reverse your anxiety. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. How do you reverse your anxiety? How do you get yourself out of that situation where you're under stress? Well, this message is going to be very, very practical for you. I'm to give you, 12 or 13 steps, and you can write them down or pick up the tape later. But I want you to know that these steps come to me by way of a lot of reading and a lot of interaction. I've picked a lot of people's brains to try to find out what do you do when you feel like the vice of life is tightening around you and you just can't handle it anymore. You see, preachers, we milk a lot of cows, but we make our own butter, so to speak. And I'm telling you, I've talked to a number of people. So I want you to pay close attention to these things. The very first thing I want you to write down is this. Understand that in order to become nice in the vice, that it begins with your mind. It begins with your thoughts. I mean, in spite of the fact that Philippians says, be anxious for nothing, but in all things let your prayers and requests be made known to God, and the peace of God that surpasses all understanding will guard your hearts and your minds until the day of the Lord Jesus. And then he goes on and says, finally, whatever is honorable and whatever is right and whatever is pure and what is of a good report, those are the things you ought to think about. We still have a tough time capturing our thoughts towards obedience to Christ. It is a tough thing to persuade people that what goes on in your mind affects everything about you. And as a result, there are some Christian disciplines that are lost these days. I'm going to name one of them. The discipline of meditation. When's the last time you just meditated on something? In this noisy, busy world, when's the last time you stepped out long enough just to think about what you're thinking about? It's an interesting phrase in the Hebrew. It has this idea. Meditating has the idea of chewing your cud. I like that. No, don't go out and buy something to chew. I'm not suggesting that. I'm saying stop and just think about it. Have you ever laid down in the park and picked a blade of grass and just kind of chewed on it, looked up at the clouds and thought about life? When's the last time you daydreamed? President Harry Truman used to say, daydreaming is some of the best rest and recuperation that I have in my life. He went on to say, I have a foxhole in my mind. And he would climb down in that foxhole, and it was there that he would dream and think about certain things going on in his life. In fact, in 1936, Jesse Owens came back from the World Games, Olympic Games, a winner, 4 gold medals. There was a great, huge press conference waiting for him. And they asked, Jesse, how did you do it? How did you beat Hitler in his own hometown? And he was quick to answer and say, it all started many years ago when I was in junior high school, and a coach looked at us and gave us a speech, and I've never forgotten the speech. He simply said, boys, you can do anything that you make up your mind to do. And immediately after saying that, Jesse said to that coach in junior high school, coach, I already know what I want to be. I want to be the fastest man in the world. To which the coach said, well, Jesse, that's quite a dream. In fact, that's probably one of the biggest dreams I've ever heard. And Jesse, there's one problem with that. And he said, what's that, coach? He said, dreams are like clouds. They kind of float around up there. And they can never become realities unless you build a ladder that will help you climb up and make those dreams become realities. One of the steps in that ladder to climbing up is to getting a hold of your mind and your thoughts and to get the principle of true focus down so you can think about what you're doing. No, it's not just good psychology. No, it's not just a part of the greatest motivators in the world speeches because it's something good to say. It's there because it's biblical and it's right and it works. What are you thinking about these days? I want to say, what's on your mind? Years ago, a fellow said to me, Johnson, don't worry about what people think, because most of them don't. And I thought about that, and I said, not only is that right about most people, there are too many things that I've done in my life that were the direct result of not sitting down and thinking it through. You see, your mind's like a computer. It doesn't even know the difference between the real and the unreal to a great extent. And it's G-I-G-O, garbage in, garbage out. And if you fill it with garbage, that's exactly what will fuel the stress and the anxiety in your life. If you keep saying to yourself and in your mind, this marriage is not going to work. This business will never get off the ground. Why, we're never going to get through these difficulties. I don't think I can make it. If that's what you say to yourself, then more than likely that is the direct result you'll get from your thoughts. Proverbs says it. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Well, this came home to me when I read about a gentleman by the name of Colonel George Hall, captured in Vietnam. He was in Hanoi Hilton. That's what they called it. You know what he did with his mind during those days? He sat down and thought about golf. Now, there's a man after my own heart, let me tell you. As he thought about golf, he would literally create golf courses in his mind. And he could see himself stepping up to the first tee, putting the golf tee in the ground, setting the ball on the tee, teeing off. Then he would see the next shot, then the next one, and he would play rounds and rounds and rounds of golf in his mind. When he was finally released some 7 years later from Hanoi Hilton, he found himself invited to the New Orleans Open. Now, he hadn't played golf in years, except in his mind. You know what he shot the first time out? 76. Yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. Just let it happen, Lord. Do you understand what I'm saying here? If there's anything you should focus on, it's on things that are honorable and right and lovely and golf and football and... Wait, I don't think that's in that verse, but it's there somewhere. Let your mind dwell on these things. I better move on because there are a number of other steps I want to give you. Some of them are very practical. The second step is not only your thoughts, but your talk. What are you saying with your mouth these days? No, I'm not talking simply about the power of positive thinking or the power of positive talking. But there is no doubt about it. You can set a course for your life with your tongue. James is clear, it's like a rudder on a ship. And I don't care how stormy the seas are, if you keep saying to yourself, we're going to die, we're not going to make it, chances are you're not going to make it. And frankly, I like to have people around me who say, we're going to make it. They say things that help you talk through your difficulties. Talk through your anxiety. Read the Psalms. David is not psychotic or neurotic. And over again in the book of Psalms, he says stuff like this. Bless the Lord, O my soul. What are you talking about, David? He is saying to himself, bless the Lord. So I said to myself, self, and he had a conversation with himself. What are you thinking, and then what are you saying to yourself? If you say, boy, I'm middle-aged, and I don't think I can make it in the job market. There's a lot of young students out there who are bright, just got out of college. I'm not sure I can do it. Then chances are, when you go in for the interview, you probably will not score too well. But if you say to yourself, you know what, I've got a lot of experience. I'm good relationally. I know how to handle a lot of difficult situations. I would be an asset as an executive secretary to any executive in the country. Sir, you better hire me today. What's holding you up? You laugh, but I want to tell you, what you say to yourself can make all the difference in the world. If all you have on the cassette tapes of your mind are the failures and the difficulties of your life, playing and rehearsing and nursing over and over again, then chances of reversing this and becoming nice in the vice are going to be very difficult. I suggest today you accept His grace. You begin to talk to yourself just a little differently. Third thing, very practical. Here's what I want you to do. Get your calendar, and I want you to set aside a specific time to worry. Will you do that for me, please? I mean it. I read over a dozen books on the subject of worry. Every one of the books said this, set aside a time to worry. See, some of you are even pitiful at the kind of time you put into worrying. You need to get some better quality time in that. For example, if you said to yourself, all right, from this hour, 8 until 9 in the morning, I'm going to worry about this, I'm going to worry about that. See, then the rest of the day you can be free from those worries. Give it some more quality investment than what you're giving it. Limit the amount of time that you give to the subject of anxiety and stress and worry. Fourth principle. I love this one. In fact, of all the principles, I think this is one of my favorites, and I hope you'll never forget it. It is the principle of living one day at a time. Don't worry about what's going to happen tomorrow. Don't get all involved in what's going to happen yesterday or what took place yesterday. See, most of your misery is left over from yesterday or it is borrowed from tomorrow. And I'm simply suggesting that you learn what it's like to live one day at a time. You know, I think there's a verse that says, this is the day the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Well, I read about a gentleman by the name of Roy Kelly. I don't know how he did it. I'm not sure exactly how he pulled it off, but listen to his story. He said Roy Kelly was informed 2 years ago that he had terminal cancer. He and his wife went home to cry and then to die. Should they keep it a secret? Well, they prayed about it. The answer was that they should no longer pray about it, but rather that they should play about it. So they put on a big party. They invited all their friends, and during the festivities, Roy held up his hand to make an announcement. You may have wondered why I called you all together. He said, this is a cancer party. I have been told that I have terminal cancer. And then my wife and I realized that we are all terminal. So we decided to start a new organization. It is called MTC. Make Today Count. And all of you have become charter members this evening. It goes on to say that since that time, the organization has grown across the country, and Roy has been too busy to die. MTC, make today count. One of the best scenes I've seen in a movie in years was in Dead Poets Society. Robin Williams sneaks up behind those students in that boys' academy and whispers in a stage whisper, carpe diem. Seize the day. Gather the rosebuds while you may. Grab hold of life. Squeeze everything you can out of it. Gentlemen, go after it. You like poetry? Go for it. You like acting? Go for it. What is it that's inside of you that excites you and moves you? Don't wait till tomorrow. Don't worry about tomorrow. Seize the day and learn to live life one day at a time. You say, but Johnson, you don't know it's difficult these days. I have some incredible mountains in front of me. John Edmund Haggai had one of those. He shares it like this. He said, the Lord graciously blessed us with a precious 8-year-old son. He is paralyzed and able to sit in his wheelchair, only with the assistance of full-length body braces. One of the nation's most respected gynecologists and obstetricians brought him into the world. But tragically, this particular doctor was overcome by grief, and he sought to find the answer in the bottom of a bourbon bottle, and due to the doctor's intoxication at the time of delivery, he inexcusably bungled his responsibility. Several of the baby's bones were broken. His leg was pulled out at the growing center. Needless abuse resulting in hemorrhaging on the brain was inflicted on this little fellow. So that during the first year of this little baby's life, 8 doctors said he could not possibly survive. But for the first 2 years, his life continued because, he says, of my lovely wife. She fed him every 3 hours with a Brecht feeder. Now listen to this. It took a half hour to prepare for the feeding. It took another half hour to clean up and put him back to bed. Not once during that time did she get out of the house for any diversion whatsoever, and never did she get more than 2 hours sleep at one time. Now, what makes this worse is John Edmund Haggai's wife was a noted singer. In fact, by the time she had reached her early 20s, some of the nation's leading musicians, sacred and secular, acclaimed her as one of the finest and most outstanding voices in contemporary female voices in America. And yet now she was marooned to her own home. How did she make it? She was no longer in the public eye. Now she was singing lullabies to her paralyzed son. How did she make it? That's the question. How was she able to be nice in the vice? Her own husband writes and says, "I attribute my son's ability to recover and his commitment not only to Christ, but to a great disposition. I attribute it to the sparkling radiance of an emotionally mature, Christ-centered mother who has mastered the discipline of living one day at a time." Come on, church. This is not the first introduction we've had to this principle. Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. And he even told you after that, each day has enough trouble of its own. Live it one day at a time. Start today. Let's go to the next one. The next principle is like this. Put actions to your analysis. Now, we can talk all day long, but when are you going to start? Do it today. That's why I like that Nike commercial. What does it say? Just do it. That's good advice. Start right now. Get your calendar, put it, plan it, schedule it, all those things, and then go do it. Give it a shot. I think it was Dr. Harry Ironsides who was always acclaimed for his strong personal life of spirituality and piety. And students would love to get a hold of him and ask him about it. And they would say, Doc, I understand that you get up every morning at about 5 o'clock and you pray and you read the Bible. And he said, that's right, son, that's what I do. Well, Doc, how do you do it? And he would simply say, I get up. Boy, that's brilliant, isn't it? That's revolutionary. Get up! Give it a shot. Now put this thing together already. If you'll think about it, if you'll talk your way through it, set aside some time to really constructively pursue this and do it one day at a time, just think of what your day would be like. You ask my wife, I try this. I get up. I mean, it's tough, but man, I get up. And all of a sudden she'll hear me. She'll say, what are you doing? I said, don't bother me. I'm talking to myself. He's up. He's headed towards the shower. Yeah, he's moving. He's got it going now. Whoa, hey, he's having a good day. Keep it up. Go, go. She said, you know, you're crazy. I said, no, I'm not. I'm talking to myself. Just let me keep going. He's going at it. He's going. Try it. Don't look at me so skeptical. Give it a shot. Talk to yourself throughout the day. Do it one day at a time. Let me give you the next one. Not only do it, but the next one is this. You're going to like this one. Get your body into it. Do you hear me? Get your body into it. And I say that is, if your problems aren't bad enough, what we do to our bodies is pretty tough. When you pour gallons of caffeine down your system, don't come to me and say, Pastor, I don't know what to tell you. I'm really nervous these days. Things are really going tough. I don't know what, you know. Some of you look like a ride at Disneyland just the way you walk inside the place, you know. And I see you and I say, what's the problem? It's chemical. It's chemical. Without a doubt, one of the first questions a doctor would ask you is, what is your diet like? Now, I know I'm touching on some really sensitive ground here, but there's no doubt about it. If you fuel it up with these things that make you higher than a kite, it really steals the real, real juice from life. Because when it wears out, it not only wears out, but it wears your body out in the process. That's why I'm so against this drug scene. I don't know how many kids I've seen whose synthesis in their mind is totally gone. To even answer, they go, I think so. And I say to myself, that's what you want? It's the same way with alcohol. Oh, I remember when I was a kid, boy, I have to confess, I'll tell you, it was graduation. We thought this was the thing to do. So, boy, we went and
We stole a bottle of blackberry rum. That's what it was. Now, we didn't know what it was. It was kind of a whiskey stuff. I don't recommend this, okay? Never. Junior high, there I was, and I had Jim McManus, my best friend. And we went out behind the shed, and I said, no one's looking, man. I cracked the label on this thing, and I was really going to be a man. Graduation, time to celebrate. I took a big slug of that stuff. I want to tell you, it was like lava going down my throat. Tears came down my cheeks. And I looked over at him and said, would you like to have some? And I will never forget his look or his answer. He said, no, I don't think I want any of that. Now, folks, let's wake up. If a kid in junior high can just see the look, do you want some? And then I've seen the results of that stuff, not only physically, but emotionally and right on down the line. If you abuse these substances, you're not a good manager of the carrying case of your spirit and of your body. And the Bible is clear. Your body is the temple of the Lord. Here's what you're managing. Several hundred million cells, 10 billion nerve cells, 60,000 miles of blood vessels, a heart that pumps 2,000 gallons per day, kidneys that filter 2,500 pints of blood per day, lungs that inhale, exhale 500 cubic feet of air per day, a skeletal system made up of more than 200 bones, a muscular system made up of more than 650 voluntary muscles, and countless involuntary muscles that control everything from heartbeats to goosebumps. And some of you do not manage this very well. Hear me and listen closely. Get your body into it. That means some exercise, some sleep. This hit me last week. I said, get on a bike, go for a ride. I live in Woodbridge. So I jumped on the bike and I rode to Balboa Island. Okay? Now, this is not what I recommend, to be nice in the vice. Now, there's several mistakes I made. One of them was getting on the bike itself. The other one was I didn't know there was a little path that would take you around the back bay, so whenever I hit Jamboree, I went up the hill. And as I was pumping, thinking that my life was going to come to an end, I said, get off the bike and walk it up the hill. And another voice said, no, as sure as you get off, 4,000 people from the church will drive by and say, we see you on that bike. So pride got in the way. And I kept pumping and pumping and pumping. But I finally made it, and when I got there, I hit the ice cream shop, which was my intent in the first. No. Get into some exercise. Treat your body a little better than what you have been. Let me give you another principle. Will you start doing something kind, something generous for somebody every single day? This is another one of those threads that I found woven not only through Scripture, but I found it in every single book I've ever read with how to negotiate stress. You want to learn how to be nice in the vice? Help somebody. Do something good for somebody at least once every single day. You could try it in your family, but make sure your wife's near a real stuffy chair somewhere where, you know, when you say, oh, hi, honey, can I get you something? You know, I don't want her to die. You know, most of you guys are like this. Honey, would you like some ice cream? Oh, yeah. Well, good, honey. Well, you're getting yours. Would you get me a bowl of it, too? You know? Surprise her. Bring her breakfast in bed. Surprise that gal at the office or that guy when he drops something. Help him pick it up real quickly. Drive by a guy the other day and he had a flat tire. It's right down here in Culver by University High School. And I could see him just pulling and tugging on that bolt and he couldn't get it loose. So I pulled over and I backed up and I had a suit on and I threw my coat off and I walked over there and said, hey, buddy, let me give you a hand. And I knew it was going to take just a quick jerk because I've had a few of those kind of experiences. And I jerked on it and I got it loose and kind of took it off. I said, you got your spare? Bring it over here. We got that on there. And boy, he just looked at me like, who are you? Where did you come from? You know? I helped him and I got him in the car and I said, well, if you go here, you can get a good deal on a tire and all that. Boy, he said, thanks a lot. He said, how did you know I needed all this? I said, well, as I drove by, I just saw you there. Well, thanks. Got my car, and I got about 2 blocks away. I felt so good just being able to be a part of helping him. It's the same way with money. One of the greatest stresses you have is money, and one of the reasons is you need to be generous. The scriptures are clear. You are not only to earn money in a legal way, you are to save money, but the other thing that surfaces constantly is you need to learn how to give and to do it generously. And I don't say that in the face of the budget demands of this church. I say that in the face of stress and anxiety. When you learn to give generously, it will do something for you. On more than one occasion have I had the wonderful privilege of quietly, silently slipping into somebody's life and giving them X amount of dollars that I knew would help them through a particular tough time. And you ought to see the look on their face. And they're so excited and say, thank you, and all this. And I said, wait a minute, thank you. Thanks for letting me have that blessing. There is a blessing in giving money away. The poet said it. He said, that money talks, I can't deny. I heard it once. It said, goodbye. Okay? You see, now, that's not what I'm talking about. See? Some of you don't know what I'm talking about yet. But I'm going to tell you what, there's a few people in this church I've met, I wish I could have them step up here now and take my place, because they're generous, Spirit-filled, God-giving kind of folk. And you can see it in their face and in their spirit. Next principle, get you some friends in your life, will you? You can never pull this off by yourself. Now, I know gals are pretty good at this, and I want to continue to reinforce that for you ladies, but can I talk to the men for a moment? Gentlemen, would you get rid of the macho mask and link up with somebody else in your life so you can learn what it's like to have support? One of the most exciting things going on in this church right now is to see men who are linking up with other men in such a way that they are sharing their anxieties and their stresses and their burdens and their blessings to such an extent that some of those things are dissipating and going away. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. A twofold cord is not easily broken. Get somebody else in your life. They will rub you and sharpen you as iron sharpens iron. And you will be amazed at how some of your anxiety and difficulties will leave because you were willing to invest your life into somebody else. Prayer is another way. That's how we started this off, if you're not aware of it. Be anxious for nothing, but pray about everything. When's the last time you prayed? I don't mean just say a prayer. I mean truly prayed a prayer. When you do, lay it on God and know that He will hear and He will respond. Prayer is not an exercise in futility. It is being open to hearing what God is trying to say to you, not simply what you're trying to say to Him. And then after you pray, obey Him. Now this is the tougher part of this message today. Because after you pray and God says to you, you know why you're so anxious? Because you're not doing what I'm asking you to do. And if you will align yourself with my ways, you're going to experience freedom. Folks, God isn't looking over the balcony of heaven saying, hey, are you enjoying life? Well, I really am. Stop it. Cut it out. If you're enjoying life, more than likely you're living it the way He wants you to, because those who don't, you can usually see it in their countenance. It usually is in their eyes. God's way is a way of freedom from stress. Obey Him. Live life the way He suggests that you do it. Now, there's another principle. I'm getting near the end, but this last principle I couldn't leave out. And it also appeared in every book I read, just about. And that is, learn to be involved in humor. Now, we've laughed a little bit here this morning, but do you understand that when you laugh, not only does it do something for your spirit, but they literally tell me there are certain endorphins that are released in your brain that can bring healing to your body? Now, some of you have said to me over the last few weeks, Johnson, you are nuts. I mean it. One guy said to me, "You are crazy. I've never laughed so hard or cried so hard in all my life." And I said, "Well, thanks a lot." He said, "No, I mean it." He says, "It's been so good for me just to get it out." And I honestly believe that sometimes it's great to be able to laugh. And particularly in church. Now, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, a preacher way back in the 1800s, this guy could make a congregation laugh, and his board got upset with him. And they called him in and they said to him, "Listen, you cannot continue making people laugh like this." You know what his answer was? He said, "Gentlemen, if you only knew how I held back, you would commend me." Well, now, while you're laughing, can I tell you, if you only knew how I held back, you would commend me. I've always wanted to put a frog in the baptismal pool. Now, I don't know why, but I've always wanted to do that. And I've always wanted to put a baby doll in these little things, you know, when I dedicate a baby, just say, "Oh, thank you, Lord." Just let it, you know. Now, I don't know why, but those thoughts kind of go through my mind every now and then. I had one person say to me, "I can't believe it. We laugh at our church." And I say, "What's wrong with that?" In fact, though I've used this piece before, I couldn't pass it up. Irma Bombeck is one of my favorite theologians. And here's what she says. She says, "In church the other day, I was intent on a small child who was turning around smiling at everyone. He wasn't gurgling, spitting, humming, kicking, tearing the hymnals, or rummaging through his mother's handbag. He was just smiling." Ever seen a kid do that, by the way? It's hilarious in church, I want to tell you. "Finally, his mother jerked him about, and in a stage whisper that could be heard in a little theater off Broadway said, 'Stop that grinning, you're in church.' And with that, she gave him a belt, and as the tears rolled down his cheeks, she added, 'That's better. Now return to your prayers.'" Here's what she says. "We sing, 'Make a joyful noise to the Lord,' while our faces reflect the sadness of one who has just buried a rich aunt who left everything to her pregnant hamster. We chant, 'If I have not charity, I become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal.' Translated in the parking lot, it comes out, 'And the same to you, fella.'" Suddenly, she writes, "I was angry. It occurred to me the entire world is in tears, and if you're not, then you had better get with it. I wanted to grab this child with a tear-stained face close to me and tell him about my God, the happy God, the smiling God, the God who had to have a sense of humor to have created the likes of us. I wanted to tell him he's an understanding God, one who understands little kids who pick their noses in church because they're bored. He even understands my shallow prayers that implore, 'If you can't make me thin, then Lord, please make my friends look fat.'" I love that line. It's worth the whole piece right there, I want to tell you. She said, "What a fool," I thought. Here was a woman sitting next to the only light left in our civilization. The only hope, our only miracle, our only promise of infinity. If we couldn't smile in church, then where were we left to go? And I want to say to you that one of the practical steps in order to help you get through life is to learn how to smile. Learn how to laugh. And know that you have a right to laugh. Know that more than anybody else on the planet, when you're linked up to the eternal and you've got His purpose and you've got His plan in your life, you have every reason in the world to laugh from your guts, even in the middle of difficulty. Choose it off the menu of life, because a smile is a curve that will straighten out a whole lot of things. And I warn some of you, your faces would make a good frontispiece to the Book of Lamentations. So be careful that if you smile, it just may crack and fall right off, okay? But if it does, pick up those pieces, and by God's grace, let Him take some of that depression and smooth it over, and some of those wrinkles and smooth them over. Let Him put a song in your heart. Let Him take some of that burden away from you. It's a very practical step. It works, and it does good like a medicine. You've been patient. Let me give you the last principle. The last principle is this. Please know in your heart that this world isn't all there is to it. Please know in your heart that this world is not all that there is to it. Some of you
are struggling on a day-to-day existence to such an extent that you wonder if this world isn't all there is. And when I have to do some of the things that I had to do even this past week, even though I felt God was so gracious to us, when one of the children's ministry staff had a funeral for their seven-month-old stillborn child. As I stood there preaching the funeral, it occurred to me that there was one three-letter word that would make all the difference to what we were facing. It's the word, yet. It's not over with, yet. You see, we live this life here, but we've got this thing twisted. Let me help you. We're in the land of the dying. We're on our way to the land of the living. See, we got it turned around. We think we're in the land of the living, and that when we die, it's over. But when you climb up Mount Perspective, and you look back over your difficulties in light of the fact that this is just temporary, that we're simply just beginning here, that someday all of those misunderstandings and those lack of answers and those difficult situations perhaps that were never truly solved to your satisfaction, someday you will wear them well. In the meantime, I would suggest that you live your life as though it were your very last days on earth. And that you do it again, one day at a time. It came home to me when I read, I think, one of the most interesting stories I've read in recent days by Tim and Darcy Kimmel in their book, Legacy of Love. They were off in the Bermuda Islands having the time of their life when they decided to explore one particular island. We decided to kill some time combing the outer beach, they write. To do that, we took a path that cut through the island foliage leading to the other side. Now listen to their story. Just before we reached the beach, we stumbled into a graveyard. Standing among the tombstones, you could look across the tropical plants and flowers and watch the surf pound a white beach. What a view. If you had to be buried, this was about as good a place as any. What took us by surprise, however, were two open graves on the edge of the cemetery. Evidence of elapsed time suggested that they had been dug many months earlier. When we got back to the harbor, I met one of the island's pastors, and in the course of our conversation, I asked about the graves. His answer opened an interesting window to the way people viewed life and death on this island. He said the island is kind of a shallow hump of sand and vegetation on a coral platform. Digging a grave in coral normally took several days. Since the island had limited refrigeration and no way to preserve a body until a grave could be dug, the government required that a couple of graves be kept ready for the next death. People were usually buried within hours of their last breath, which raised a question for Darcy. She said, well, how do you assemble people in time for a funeral? His answer caught me unprepared, she writes. He said, they do the best they can for those who die suddenly, but if you happen to have a prolonged illness, they simply have your funeral in advance.
I love this story.
Your family and friends carry you into the church or assemble in your house and have the funeral service with you there listening to all of it. Now, he saw the look on my face and he assured me that it wasn't as strange as it sounded. In most cases, it worked rather well. Especially, it was nice if you got to hear a lot of great words about yourself. Unfortunately, the pastor said, these people were really brutal about their honesty and had a reputation for brutal honesty. For some people, it added up to a bad news situation. The bad news is you're going to die. The other bad news is that you're going to have to hear what we think about your life before you check out. The cold truth about your life would make you want to die, he said in some instances. Now listen to this. On a couple of occasions, however, the person who was supposed to die spoiled everything by recovering. Can you imagine?
You get the guy in the room, you tell him what a jerk he's been, you think he's going to die, and then he recovers.
And they say, apparently attending your own funeral and hearing your eulogy in advance has a positive effect on those who live to tell about it. If good words are spoken over them, the reluctant corpses seem more inclined to keep up the good work. If they receive bad news at the funeral, they become motivated to change their lives for the better. I ended with a question last week. Let me end with a couple of them this week. The first one will be this. If your friends and family got you together and gave you your eulogy in advance, what would they say about your life? The second question would be this. Would they say that you had learned how to be nice in the vice? Let's bow together and think about that. Well, Lord, I would like to think that because of your grace and because of the person of Christ, that if we exercise these principles and put them to work, boy, it would really improve our lives. Make better salesmen out of us, better husbands, better fathers, better human beings. And Lord, it all starts with what has been planted in the soil of our minds here this morning. I pray that you would hold the enemy at bay and allow the truths of your word to be planted deep in the soil of our hearts so that we could learn how to negotiate this life the way that you would want us to. I thank you for this congregation and for their vitality and for their love of you and others. I pray that they would go out and share that with as many people as they can and that you would give them a great harvest to your glory. I ask it in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.